Hello everyone and welcome to this exclusive How I've Made This session. I'm Peter Damaris, an online educator and maker, author of Maker Education Revolution and instructor at Tech Explorations. My mission is to help people learn electronics, programming, printed circuit board design, and lots more. But most important, to help as many people as possible to enjoy the tinkering with technology and with their technology education adventures. In this session, I'm really excited to introduce you to my guest maker, Mark Wilson. Mark is also known by his nickname, Funny Polynomial, which I quite like actually. Mark spent part of his younger years coding his Accord Electron in BBC Basic and 6502 assembly. And I've actually tried that myself and it is fun. It's good fun. He used this computer to code many implementations of Conway's Game of Life. He later completed a master's in physics, about which he has expressed his surprise, and became employed as a software developer. His career as a software developer brought Mark to where he is now and into the world of electronics and the Arduino. Mark discovered the Arduino in 2011 and started building gadgets. One of those gadgets is Kenbach Uino. Kenbach Uino is Mark's implementation of an early computer of the 1970s, inspired by the Kenbach One, a computer built in 1971. Kenbach One's only user interface consists of 12 LEDs and 17 switches. Kenbach Uino is powered by, of course, an Atmega 328. I came across Mark's work as I was browsing Hackaday, and I was impressed by one gadget in particular, FlipClock. FlipClock is a clock powered by an Arduino Uno and a color LCD screen. What is amazing about this clock is the quality of the animation that Mark achieved, considering the hardware limitations that he had to deal with. It's hard to believe what Mark was able to do with just 32 kilobytes of flash memory and 2 kilobytes of RAM. Mark admits that he enjoys coding, pushing pixels around, and horology. That's a word that I really hear. So I invited Mark to join me in this session and show us how he did it. So Mark, thank you for accepting my invitation, and I'm really looking forward to your presentation and learning more about the FlipClock. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm in the t-shirt of the day. 6502, I happen to be in rotation anyway, so
that's awesome.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope this is informative and of some use to some people out there, inspiring them to make an Arduino. So here it is here, exactly 8 o'clock. That's good timing. If we pause, we probably won't see it flip because a watch clock never flips. So you can see it's quite a simple little device. The origin of the device, I mean, I've made several Arduino's devices, several different Arduino projects, a lot of clocks. I do enjoy making clocks, and I tend to, even though I think recently on Hackaday there was a suggestion that making a clock is a cliche, and I guess that's true, but I also have a theory that it's the minimal useful thing. When you've finished it, it actually has a purpose and has a reason to be sitting around in your home, whereas a lot of things, a blinking LED, you know, isn't very useful. And of course, anything more complicated than that gets to be quite complicated. So I'm a big fan of making clocks, and there are plenty of opportunities for different design ideas, different ways of displaying the time. The origin of this particular one is I was working on another project with an LCD where the interface to the LCD, and there's this whole complicated ecosystem of LCD shields, clones, it's quite complicated. But this particular one, and I think most of them, have a very simple interface, where you can define, send some commands to the device to define a rectangle on the screen, and then you stream a series of pixels, and it will fill in those pixels on that rectangle. So in doing that, and I was thinking about, and I think I'd seen an ad, a travel agent ad, where they tend to use those flip displays in airports.
Yep.
I was looking at that, and it somehow came to me, the idea of defining the letters for a clock, for the flip things, and by omitting a certain number of rows, I could get the look of a tipped flip clock flap. And I sort of filed that away until later on I came across a quite large, nice and colorful LCD. So I set about implementing it. And it did take a long time because I was concerned about making the animation of the flip look reasonable quite fast. It's fair to say with me, as an idea, I think until 2 years, 2 years went by. So the guts of it anyway is that the essence of it is for the flipped, a flipped digit to draw 3 out of 4 rows, which achieves an angle, an apparent angle in 2D, admittedly, an apparent angle of 41 degrees, which is pleasantly close to 45 degrees, because the flip tends to have 3 steps, you know, there, there, straight out, straight down, and there. And I can later on flip to a screenshot of that animation. So I spent a lot of time working on this and encouraged by pleasing results. I'm always motivated by doing a little bit and seeing the results. And that's the cool thing about playing with an LCD, you get to see cool graphics. In many ways, this is also sort of the opposite of my job. You know, at work, I'm dealing with 2 million lines of code. I've got dual monitors, 500 gig of space. And here I'm dealing with 480 by 320 pixels, 3.1K, 31K rather. So it's a nice opposite of work. One of the things I enjoy about it. Also, just the challenge of working in small spaces with very, very limited results. And while it's true that I'm sure there, well, I know there are phone apps and so on that will do this look. You can get a clock for your phone that has the flip clock style. Where's the fun in that?
Actually, Mark, just as you're saying that, I've got to say that I have tried myself to build a clock using the technologies that I'm familiar with. But you know, I went a different way to what you did. Like, I wanted to make my clock super complicated, probably because I'm influenced with apps on smartphones, touch screens, and lots of capabilities, sync with internet clocks, putting reminders on, alarms, time zones. So I thought, yeah, then I won't be able to do that. And then I thought I'll do it with the Raspberry Pi. And that's when I got bogged down by all this functionality that I want to put in that gadget, where you said, I want to use an Arduino to build something simple, just one key feature, right? You want to make it realistic and you want to achieve that animation. So do you think that was the challenge for you to just get that one thing right using those limited resources that you mentioned? Maybe that's like a good lesson for us to take as well. Just go for one thing.
It was all about getting that flip, that look, fast enough that it looked subconsciously like it had flipped. You know, if you stop and look at each frame, it's not so, because the shading and so on isn't so good. But yes, it was first and foremost about, can I achieve a reasonable looking flip look? And having got that, I then went quite a bit further.
Yes, but there was one thing that got you started.
And I think that's the important thing for me, is to be on the lookout for inspiration and challenges that are the right balance between not being trivial,
yeah,
and also not being so hard that you get discouraged and that kind of thing. And, you know, sometimes it turns out okay. It turns out, well, actually, that wasn't trivial and it wasn't super hard. The happy medium.
Well, you've got a history of projects like that, right? You look for something simple, like the 1971 computer.
Ironically, as my first project, that was quite well, but there's software simplicity and hardware simplicity. And as a software guy, I consider those two different categories, because the software is endlessly mutable. I can fiddle around with it to my heart's content. Once you hit hardware, it's a little different. It's less forgiving once you start soldering things. So, but that's a whole another thing. And that's actually one of the things about this thing, is the absolutely minimal enclosure. Because on many of my projects, I've done all the coding, a little prototype sitting on my desk, and then I get to the step where I'm like, okay, now I need an enclosure for this. And quite often, there's a lengthy pause there when I work out, okay, how am I going to do this? Because my go-to is laser cut. But, you know, that's quite an involved thing. And it's just, it's a tricky transition going for it. purely software, entirely virtual, to physical things that you've got to bolt together and make fit. And 9 times out of 10, I never have quite as much room in the enclosure as I would really like.
I think that's a common problem. Like, I have the same thing. That's one of my motivations for actually purchasing a 3D printer, which I never really ended up using because it's so slow and all this. Like, you end up with an enclosure issue. You build an enclosure for what you thought originally would be good enough, and then you've got to do it again. It takes another couple of days of design, prototyping. I would say eventually you give up. But yeah, that's a common problem. So in your case, you're using a much simpler solution to finish up your project, right? You don't go for a complicated enclosure 3D printed. What's your solution to that?
Well, in this case, it's just two plates.
Yeah,
two. In fact, the way it's made, which is also trying to minimize the hardware complexity, in that it's a Uno, you know, with a blank shield. It's a sandwich of three boards.
Hmm.
Uno, blank shield with some with the RTC module and a couple of buttons, and then on top of that the LCD. So it's a stack of three things. And in fact, it's wide enough that it would stand by itself. But I figured I'd give it a little bit of protection. So two laser cut acrylic plates, and that's it. And you know,
four
it's actually
spaces.
Quite liberating.
Yep. So then that now stays, is permanently on your desk and telling you the time.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. That's great. Tell us how you've done it. Like, maybe walk us through your process. I know that at least on the software side is quite involved. So the floor is yours. Show us how you've done it.
It's quite involved. I'll switch to my share. Yes. To the IDE. All right, so here's the Arduino IDE. And the first thing to see is I've got a lot of tabs. I think you can see that.
Yep.
This is the first tab, the primary, the sketch.ino file. Lots of includes, some comments, but not a great deal going on in here. So my approach is always to go for new tabs, new files early. This is not exactly object oriented, but I do try to apply some of those principles, in particular division of labor. So basically I'll have a C++ file, CPP file, and a header file for every distinct kind of thing that's going on. So I've got a button file, and this is the module that's responsible for debouncing the buttons and telling me whether they've been pressed or held, that kind of thing. There's a clock, which is actually the main logic for the flip clock. Config, which is a class that reads and writes settings to EEPROM. So it's got a setting here about whether the clock is running in 24-hour mode or not. It also has a method to call to bring up the configuration screen. So, and so on and so on. Cubes, you see different faces for the clock. And I've got a lot of them. And in fact, that's one of the slightly awkward things about the IDE. It tends to not do so well when you've got a lot of tabs. But my approach is always to divide it up into separate modules. Just keeps things cleaner. You know where to go. And you know, I've seen plenty of projects where it's a single file of many, many lines, and you're constantly going up and down. It's suboptimal. And you know, if I was at work, working on my job, I would be, you know, I'd be trying to make a bigger effort to be object oriented, cleaner interfaces, that kind of thing. But I'm not at work, so I sort of I relax about that kind of thing. I can give myself a break and have some globals, you know. But having said that, I do try to, you know, have namespaces. If nothing more than a class with some static names. Not that that is. So that's my approach. And then just add to it, grow it. I mean, this would have started off as one file. I would have, and these are files that I've used in other projects as well. So I can drag and add to the project the button stuff. I know it's going to debounce it properly. And then the thing just grew and grew. And as you'll know, if you've read the project, you know, I did the flip clock and then found that I had space left over of the 32K and was quite inspired by the LCD, So I threw in a Pong clock and a crazy cube-based clock and a sort of a triangle one, a number of clocks until I finally filled the sketch up, and at that point I stopped. And also, you know, I liked them all, and I didn't want to make four of them, so I combine them all into one, and you press a button, and it switches between faces, and if I get bored, I can switch to a different face. So that's I'm not sure what else I can say about my approach. But like I said, I'm motivated by making progress, so incremental progress is good. I also, almost always on the main file, have a comment, which is a to-do list.
Yeah, I was about to ask about comments and like documenting the code in the code itself, not separately.
Oh, absolutely.
How do you do that?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, if I was at work, I'd be writing far more comments probably. Well, maybe not. But here, yeah, I mean, it's a cliche, but you'll save yourself so much time if when you write some method, some function, you at least put a one-liner in there. To say what it's meant to be doing, because if you come back to it 6 months later, you may well have forgotten. So yes, comment, clear names, you know, all those general programming principles. But one of the important ones is division of labor. There's a class that's responsible for talking to the LCD, and all the nitty-gritty details are hidden away in that. There's a class for talking to the real-time clock module, and, you know, pulling that data out from the real-time clock module, which is in BCD, and converting that into decimal. But all that's tucked away in separate modules. Just makes life so much easier.
Yeah. What's your approach to using external libraries? Because from the quick look that you've given us, I don't see that many inclusions of third-party libraries. Do you actually use any, or do you just try to go solo?
I do sometimes. I think this one does use, it doesn't, but others I've used an I2C library that allows you to pick the pins. Actually, I suspect this one does. It's a really big project. Even I've forgotten what's going on here. But this was saying about the ecosystem of LCDs, and there are a number of large libraries that attempt to deal with all of them, and you sort of configure them and say which one you've got. And I've had limited success with those. And I personally just really like paring it down to the minimum and having all of the code that's my own, because there's a lot of cruft with those libraries. Well, I tend to think there is. And also, because they're so general, they're often quite slow. So with this one, I found some code associated with the LCD, and I modified it and put my own layer on top of it. But modifications like doing direct register access. So instead of doing digital write and that kind of thing,
You had to really get into the nitty gritty of the display hardware, right, and learn about its internals in a way so that you can program it directly instead of generic library.
Arduino registers. Oh, to a library, yes, you do. But these are the Arduino registers, so it's a lot quicker to send the data to the LCD.
Yeah, I also noticed that you don't have files with an INO or INO extension, which are the ones that the Arduino IDE really understands and automatically includes. So you are kind of more oriented towards using just plain C for your Arduino program, especially of this size, right, instead of going through the framework.
Well, the flip clock is an INO, but all the other ones, yeah, I guess I've always just done CPPs and .h's because that's what I do at work. It's what I think of as the natural way of defining additional files. The .ino, I guess, is required because that's the, you know, the file that corresponds to the folder.
Yeah.
It's effectively who knows how the Arduino does its stuff, but behind the scenes, there's some magic going on. Because it really just compiles, I think, every file it finds in a folder and then tries to link them together. Not sure. This is the pattern I've got into, without really thinking about it too hard. And, you know, I always have a Pragma once at the header file. I'll usually have the class, and they'll have a single external instance of that class, which is defined, you know, in the.
So you can access it elsewhere.
So there's just there's a single global, well, there are two button objects in this case. There's a single clock object for the RTC. I'm not saying it's the best way of doing it. There are probably better ways, but it works. And like I say, it's fairly relaxed because it is a hobby.
Exactly.
I've only relatively recently started using some of the more modern, what I think of as modern, Pragma 1. So I used to do FDF, you know, underscore file name, that kind of nonsense. But that's Pragma 1 is quite nice. And I've only recently realized that you can, for example, this is getting a little technical, but you can use things like, so I'm using enums, enumerations here, for various things. Oh, this enumeration here is the various faces for the clock. So it's got the flip clock, cubes, triangles, pong, random. But you can use, for example, the class keyword here. I don't know when that was introduced into C++, but it makes this enumeration more strongly typed.
These are some of the things that they're not really easy to find as a beginner. Like there's no book that I'm aware of where all these things are concentrated and you can just sit and learn. Like, how do you go about this? It's like, are you bringing a lot of knowledge that you have from work from other projects? Because another thing that happens with the Arduino is that the C++ implementation is like a subset of what you'd find on a PC. So how do you discover what works and what doesn't?
I guess I've just tried it. I just recently tried class, enum class, sure enough.
And it worked.
Another one I tried, this is, you can always edit this out. you know, you can do, in C++, you can do things like no discard, which is effectively an attribute on the method. Which is, that's a silly example. But what it basically means is if this method returns an int, you can't just ignore what it returns. You have to acknowledge that it's returned, you know, success or failure or something. But it turns out that that feature is not supported. Who knows, in the future version of the IDE, it might be. But, I've been doing C++ for 25, 30 years, so I just know, I don't know how to advise someone getting into it. I mean, you can just write C. It just gets harder and harder with a big project. And there's really no reason for this, even this, to be a big project. It's only a big project because I thought, hey, I've got space left over and I quite like this LCD.
Yeah.
So I'll throw this extra stuff in.
I wonder, like, a couple of questions are popping up now. Just a basic one is the IDE itself. Like, I'm sure you're using something totally different at work when you're building large applications. Have you considered using something else for the Arduino as well for projects like this, where like 20 files, like a platform IO, or some like MS Code or one of those editors?
I've heard of those and I've thought about it, but I haven't been motivated to switch over. I mean, this works for me, and yeah, it works, and I'm used to it, and it's that clear division of what I do here at home as a hobbyist and what I do at work.
Yeah, like, it's amazing. Like, I haven't seen, I've never built a project like this, like, of this size for the Arduino, and I kind of felt that I need to move on to something more capable, as like syntax highlighting, for example. Once I get used to that, it's hard to go back to the Arduino, IDE.
I may well find that if I ever switched, I would probably look at this as kind of a bit of a toy. And any of the syntax highlighting is a little annoying. I mean, if you happen to name a variable or something, see, there we are. I've got parameters called min and max, and it's highlighting them because there are methods called min and max. So yes, it's a bit of a toy, but I actually quite like that. It's all part of the sort of casualness, the limited space, limited resources, 8-bit, you know, it's all part of that environment, I think. I think it's quite quaint, perhaps.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Like, I do feel more relaxed myself when I use the Arduino IDE versus Platform IO that I started using about a year ago. I feel happier. I don't know, it's just the simplicity. Like, that's one thing that I like about the Arduino itself, is that it's simple. And I think it really fits well with the programming environment as well, the fact that it is also simple and I don't have to be confused about its functionality. So I think there's a point to be made there, and it is becoming more capable over the years. Newer versions add more features, but as long as it doesn't become like a full-blown Arduino IDE, then you always have that choice of simplicity versus complexity.
You have a choice, yeah. But I think that this is, it's quite friendly, and I think it's pretty accessible, and it does the job.
Yeah. You know? I've got another question about this, like also a technical question. So I'm sure at work, like one of the cornerstones of software engineering is testing. So there's people bragging about this one line of testing for one line of code that is doing stuff. How do you deal with that for the Arduino? And in this particular project, how did you do all the testing? Because it's a lot of code, things can go wrong, there's bugs. How do you find them?
Yeah, well, I use it a lot. You know, when I'm sitting here for hours at a time playing with it, you know, I'm...
Time passes. You need a clock.
Sorry?
Time just flies through. You need a clock.
Yeah. One of my early projects, actually, sitting on the table over there, was a clock with a red button and a green button, where I would sit down. If I was going to work on a project, I'd push the green button. So I've started working on it, and then I'd push the red button at the end. As an indication of how long have I actually spent working on this thing. But after a while, I stopped doing that because it was quite depressing. I'll work on it. I'm building it up incrementally, usually, so I'm sort of testing as I'm going. It's like I would test anything. I'll interact with it. And, you know, sometimes things will surprise me. I think it's pretty good. And I put particular effort into it when I know I'm going to be publishing it, you know, I'm going to be putting it out on the web or whatever. If it's just for my own internal consumption, I wouldn't be too concerned about it. But when I know other people are going to look at it.
Is your testing automated, or do you just, you've got like a routine of I'm going to press this now, see what happens, I'm going to change this variable and upload again, do a printout and see what happens?
It's a mix of those things. When I know there's a corner condition that I need to test, you know, I will have a little to-do list of corner conditions and explicitly exercise those. I mean, it's been pretty relaxed about it, so I'll try to cover all the bases and do my best, but nowhere near the rigor that I would have in a work project. But at a work project, there are other people who test my software for me, which is good and bad. It's just me, and I'll put a fair bit of effort into it. I mean, it'll still surprise me. I'm still finding issues, minor issues. One of the problems I found with this project was taking photographs of it. Getting the angle right and avoiding glare and that kind of thing. So relatively recently I modified the sketch so that the commands that I and the data that I send to the LCD, I send out to the serial port as well, and I captured that in a file, wrote some Python code to interpret that to basically build a screenshot, a PNG of the screen. And in the course of doing that, I got some weird results, which don't show up on the LCD, but were showing up in this program. And I think it was something to do with integer overflow. I think sometimes the Arduino with complicated expressions, I sometimes get unexpected results. If I'm mixing like a byte type and an int type, sometimes the conversion from type to type will surprise me and I'll get an odd result. So it's never free of bugs, but it's good enough.
Yeah, that's right. That's another element, I guess, of the kind of work that you're doing, is that it's fun. So it's okay to have a bug. But I guess one thing that I've found with projects like that is that probably a main method of figuring out whether it's working as it should is to just let it work for a large amount of time, like for a few days or a few weeks. In the case of the clock, it's interesting to see what happens when it flips over, like when it goes straight from 11:59, switches over to midnight, 00:00. Yeah, to see if I actually managed to do that without crashing or rebooting or something like that. Like those edge conditions, you can actually foresee and expect them and wait to see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a good point. And in fact, you know, one of the things I'll sometimes do is introduce a testing mode so that, for example, it will rapidly flip through. So I won't wait for a minute before it flips. It'll just go flip, 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 flip. So I can exercise all those. And in fact, that brings up a good point. There is a bug in it. I'll call it a feature, in that I think there are scenarios where the digit is flipping, and if it's like 8:59, when the 5 flips over to reveal the 0 for, 9 o'clock, you will actually very briefly see a 6,
mm-hmm.
because the logic is just saying, well, what's the next digit, and it's not taking into account the position and the fact that, and so on and so on. And I discovered that the other day. I thought, it's quirky. It's a flash. So I'm not going to invest any more time. And I've spent a lot of time on this, and I'm happy with it. It's a quirk.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, try to anticipate what can possibly go wrong. I guess one of the responsibilities of the programmer, just like the hardware designer, whenever you build something, it's not just to figure out how to get the thing to do what you want it to do, but also what can possibly go wrong. And both include methods of dealing with the problem if you expect that it's going to happen, or to avoid it in the first place. But somehow you need to anticipate it and like engineer the final device to deal with it.
Yes, although thinking outside the box to imagine those sorts of scenarios that you clearly didn't think of originally is quite difficult. But I guess given enough time and tinkering with it, you'll think, oh, well, what happens if I do this? You know, does it do the right thing flipping over at midnight? Does the date and the time all update? Those sorts of things. So yeah, it's a matter of giving some thought to that. And as you're doing things in the code, you need to be conscious of, oh, have I handled the case where, you know, the read of the real-time clock failed? I probably haven't, but that's the sort of thing I mean, to keep an eye out for that kind of thing.
Yeah, right. So, Mark, another question that I have is in relation to source control. Like lately, I started using Git with my platform IAO projects and also with my simpler Arduino IDE projects. Earl takes or I use Git to maintain history. Do you do any of that?
Yeah, I do. The source control is a big deal at work, but I relatively recently, last year or so, switched to using that home Tortoise SVM because I don't understand Git. It's too much for my brain. So quite often, you know, at the end, I've had a couple of hours session adding stuff to the code. At the end of that time, before I shut things down, I'll check that into Tortoise SVM.
Yeah,
and gives me a happy feeling that, you know, I'm seeing with a sensible check and comment. So I'm seeing a history of what I've done. And if I decide that I've really messed things up, I can go back. I can revert those changes. Whereas before, I was forever copying things, making a zip, calling it 01, and then making another one called 02, which just felt really weird. So I strongly, Tortoise SVN, and I think there are others out there that are free. And it also makes doing a real backups easier because you can like grab the repository of all of the things you've got checked in and burn them on a disk. So I highly recommend source control and having that discipline of doing reasonably regular check-ins.
Yeah, it does become eventually second nature. Like normally I would just command S after adding a couple of lines. But now when I finish working on a feature, just automatically, before I think of what I'll do next, just check it into Git. I guess that's automatic for you as well, right?
It is, and it's part of the discipline at work. And it feels quite reassuring to be doing that aspect of work at home. It does feel good. I always felt a bit guilty about, you know, the big projects that I've spent a lot of time on, huge amounts of code, lots and lots of changes, And there's just, you know, no source control. It did feel weird. So I highly recommend it.
Great. So Mike, show us the clock in action. Actually, we haven't seen it yet. So what does it look like when it's working and flipping?
Sure. Well, I guess I was waving it around, but it probably wasn't flipping at the time. So this is a YouTube video. It's quite short. So you can see the, by the time I put the big digits in, there wasn't room for a colon in between. So I stuck it up above. So there we have the flip. So yeah, I'm quite happy with that. It's quite hypnotic, really.
And you've got four themes that the clock can display. You can choose. There's a button, I think, on the back in the sandwiched assembly of the Arduino and the Shield.
There's a couple of buttons. Yeah, one to set the time, but if you just set the pause that.
That's the problem with YouTube. You never know what's going to be next.
Yeah. So yes, there's another button where it'll cycle through the different faces.
All right.
And I could switch to some photographs of that if you'd like.
Sure.
Okay. So here's this screenshot I was talking about where I captured the pixel data. So it's a far clearer view. And as you can see, I've gone to ridiculous lengths making these little details because, you know, this was the ongoing second and third pass to refine the look, these little black borders and the indication of a wheel. So there's other clock faces as well. So this is a one which just draws some slightly distorted triangles and a really crude font of the time, but the colours sweep through each minute. The sort of colour scheme changes, so it looks quite cool. There's another example. Here's an example of the stages in the flipping. Catch at each part. Here's a weird little one, which is, in hindsight, really hard to read.
Yeah, okay, it's 152, is that right?
That's right, 0152.
You need to train the eye for this.
it's quite challenging. But, you know, these are just the sort of things that I can't quite remember how this came to me, but I did find a font that looks a lot like this eventually. But I was thinking about just things that are colourful. What can I do that's got lots of colours? Probably thinking a bit about Rubik's Cube. In fact, yeah, I definitely was thinking Rubik's Cube.
It is very creative. What's really interesting to me is that how the last two plates, or plate faces, I should say, or themes, came after your original relatively simpler idea of what the clock would look like and how it would work. And that original simple idea gave rise to like the Rubik Cube type clock, which is, I think, it is a lot more complicated both to envision how it's going to work and then to implement it.
Yes.
But it was a natural conclusion. Oh, no, not natural conclusion, but like, I guess, part of the evolution of your idea.
Yeah, the drawing of this was quite challenging, given that the interface is to define a rectangle and fill it with colour. So there was some tricky things going on there to get that look. And the same with this one here. I was just inspired to play around until I ran out of memory. Thank goodness, or I'd probably still be going.
And you did. Well, yeah. It took you a while, but eventually you ran out of memory, even though it was 32 kilobytes.
And in fact, the very last clock, I don't have a shot of it here, but it's a little Pong clock, and it didn't quite fit. So I had to do some slightly dodgy things to just peel back 10 or 20 bytes. I think making a function call actually uses up a fair bit of memory. So if you just reference globals, you save space.
It's amazing. Well, I can see what you mean when you say that you like pushing pixels around. This is like the epitome of that.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Well, I'd like to ask you, so we're getting closer to the end of this session, I'd like to ask you, how would you recommend or suggest or advise a maker watching this to learn from your work, learn from your project? Like, how can they dissect what you've done to learn C++, manipulating pixels, working with memory, registers, whatever, in the Arduino? What do you think?
Well, that's a big question. You know, an interested party could look at the sketch. There's a lot to look at. Probably a bit overwhelming. I don't know. I think for me that the takeaway is about keeping an eye out for inspiration, and not being afraid to start with something simple and have it grow and grow. There's a massive amount of stuff out there, help online. I don't know how useful it is. It's hard for me to imagine as a non-programmer or a non-experienced programmer to come into this world. But, you know, start simple. I mean, start with, you know, I started with making an LED blink, built-in LED, and that was quite revolutionary. And here I am blinking many, many, many little tiny LEDs.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think, your advice is really good. Like, it starts with inspiration. The technical issues typically can be solved one way or another. But I think I see that from my students as well. It's that first step, that first inspirational step that seems to be holding people back. Like, you found this project, it just came to you because you are crazy about clocks. And timekeeping machines, and that became a project that brought you towards getting the Arduino to reach its limits when it comes to graphics, and that gave rise to other projects later on and guided your learnings. But I guess that's the first step, right?
Yeah, look out for something that inspires you enough to take the next step. And put the effort in, and you know, don't feel that the Arduino is surprisingly capable, so you can push it quite a long way. But I would say that whatever you're doing, right from the word go, organize it carefully. You know, division of labor, spread it across multiple files, comment things, that sort of stuff. It'll help in the end. You'll appreciate in the end, 6 months later, when you're looking at it.
Well, I guess that is perfect, because my next question is, from a technical point of view, what are the three or four key learnings that you'd like the listeners or the people watching this to take with them? I think you already hit one of them. Division of labor is important. What else, from a technical point of view, would you advise people to take away?
From a technical point of view, division of labor, somewhat object oriented, divide the task up, take it in small amounts, you know, incrementally grow the project, start off by, you know, in my case, start off by getting a single square on the screen. And that alone was, you know, that was quite a step to actually get the thing working. So take your time and embrace the fact that it's not your job. So, you know, you
relax.
And, you know, weeks would go by where I just couldn't be bothered. But then all of a sudden I'd get keen and I'd spend, you know, several hours every night. But pacing yourself is important. You know, you don't have to do this. So at any time you can just walk away.
Yep.
As I said, I think that, for me personally, I think a clock is a really good thing, because, like I said, it's, to me, it's the minimally useful thing. You end up with something that's got a reason for living. It's got a purpose. Even though you're surrounded by clocks and you don't really need to know the time, it's got a clear purpose, and anyone else looking at it can see that it has a clear purpose. And I guess the other thing too is that the other half is the hardware, and that need not be complicated. I mean, the hardware in this project isn't complicated. There was a bit of soldering, but not a vast amount. It's stacking shields, and I took advantage of that. I mean, the shield, you just plug it in and it goes. So there's that. And the other thing too is an enclosure. You know, relax about having a beautiful and bamboo laser cut enclosure. You may not need anything, or you can do something really simple.
Yeah, keep it simple. Exactly.
Keep it simple, yeah.
I like that.
As simple as you want it to be.
Personally, like the key takeaway lessons that you gave us are all really good. One that I like in particular is the usefulness of the project. So, okay, the LED and blinking it is fun, but it's not useful, right? And it doesn't drive you to make the LED blink better or whatever. But a clock or whatever that other useful project might be, because it's useful, it will drive you to stick with it and make it work eventually. So find that useful project that resonates with you and go for it, relax and go for it. Awesome. Okay, I've got one more. There's quite a lot of ground that you covered, from a technical perspective, but also from an approach as a makeup perspective. Are there any learning resources that you have particularly found useful for yourself that you would recommend our viewers to also access and look for?
Well, Google is your friend for all things, almost everything.
Any books, particular websites?
The Arduino website and the forums, the Arduino forums, but all forums.
I think Hackaday as well, like for inspiration.
Just looking at things and saying, wow, that was cool. I wish I'd thought of that. That's not so much a technical support. Yeah, I don't know where I get my technical support. I'm a programmer, so the programming side comes kind of naturally to me. I do sometimes struggle with the electronics side, but there are forums, plenty of forums. Can't think of any now, but the Arduino one has got a lot of good stuff.
Do you have a favorite C or C++ programming book? Oh, those do tend to be very big, but do you have like a go-to reference?
Oh, I haven't looked at a book for a long time.
Do you Google things?
I really do. A lot of those things I was mentioning about the Enum class and the no discard things, I look them up. There's really no better answer to most questions than to go to your Google thing and type it in.
And faster,
take it with a grain of salt. But either that or go to the library or talk to people. So no, I mostly use Google because it means I don't have to get up from my desk. It's just there.
Me too. Okay, well, Mark, that was awesome. How can people get in touch with you? Do you have a favorite medium of communication?
So I'm thinking you can message me here, or potentially email. Do you want me to give out my email?
No, it's okay. We'll have it. We'll have your contact details in
It's a long email. funnypolynomial@gmail.com. So
yeah.
And that's one I sometimes even mistype myself.
It's a true email for a software developer.
So that's probably the best way to approach me, I think.
Okay.
And I'm happy to answer questions about it.
Definitely. Do you have the code for FlipClock somewhere, like on GitHub or somewhere?
Well, it's here on it's under this somewhere down here. There's a zip file. Here we are at the bottom. I do have a few things. I have a few things on GitHub. Do I have a link for that handy? I think I'm Funny Polynomial on GitHub, including the Ken Baguino, if people are interested. And I'll probably put more things on GitHub, but this is fine.
Awesome. Well, Mark, that was awesome. I really enjoyed the presentation. Really give me an insight about your work and especially FlipClock. So thank you for taking the time to talk about it.
Welcome. Thank you for having me. I hope it was informative.